This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The White House says the United States hopes to build a stable relationship with Russia, but does not expect trust in its dealings with Moscow. The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says that President Biden talked with Russian President Vladimir Putin Tuesday to express U.S. concerns over the Russian military buildup along Ukraine's border. She says Biden called on Putin to de-escalate tensions and proposed a summit in a third country. Psaki says the summit was being discussed for the coming months, which would mean this summer. She says the U.S. still plans to punish Russia for election interference and a huge cyber attack despite Washington reaching out to the Kremlin, and President Biden was clear there will be consequences. The wife of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny says her husband is suffering the effects of his hunger strike. Navalny began the strike at the end of last month in protest over a lack of medical care for severe back and leg pain. His wife on Tuesday now saying he has a hard time speaking and has lost a lot of weight. But prison officials will still not let a doctor examine him. According to the Associated Press, Navalny's team says authorities are threatening to start force-feeding him. Russia's prison service claims a panel of doctors assessed Navalny's health as satisfactory. The 44-year-old survived the near-fatal poisoning last year and was arrested when he returned to Moscow in January following life-saving treatment in Germany. This is VOA News. Britain is apparently ready to remove nearly all of its troops from Afghanistan following the U.S. plan to withdraw by September 11th. The Times reports Britain plans to hand over control of an academy in Kabul where troops help to train Afghan soldiers. There are about 750 British troops in Afghanistan who would struggle without U.S. support because of the reliance on U.S. bases and infrastructure, again, according to the Times. A senior United States administration official announced on Tuesday that all U.S. troops in Afghanistan will be withdrawn by September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center in New York. It delays only by 5 months an agreement with the Taliban by former President Donald Trump to withdraw all troops amid a growing consensus in Washington that little more can be achieved. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says President Biden has been consistent in his view that there is not a military solution to Afghanistan, and the U.S. has been there far too long. The African Union will launch a partnership to manufacture vaccines at 5 research centers to be built on the continent within the next 15 years. The World Health Organization says only 2% of all vaccines has gone to Africa, citing supply, funding, and manpower concerns. The Africa Union announcing Tuesday the group behind the global COVAX vaccine sharing program will work to boost research and development as well as manufacturing. The 20-year target is to produce locally 60% of all vaccines used on the continent. That is compared with only 1% today. The World Health Organization says Africa has so far been the least affected region by the pandemic, with 4.3 million cases and 114,000 deaths. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the United States is deeply disappointed by Somalia's approval of legislation that extends the terms of the President and members of Parliament by 2 years. Blinken says the U.S. is considering all available tools, including sanctions and visa restrictions, to respond to efforts to undermine peace and stability. Somalia's lower house of parliament voted Monday to extend the president's 4-year term, which expired in February, for another 2 years. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 14, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Outrage in Mali over the assassination of a rebel leader that some are calling a peacemaker.
This is to say that this man did not have the appropriate security details in Mali, that strategic partners of Mali or even Malian playing key role are not protected in this country, and that is really outrageous.
A student is dead following a school shooting Tuesday in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Villagers complain about the impact of the Uganda-Tanzania oil pipeline, and yet another appeal for hundreds of thousands of people affected by conflict in Mozambique.
As the security situation continues to deteriorate, more than 950,000 people in the north of Mozambique are now facing severe hunger.
And Zimbabwe schools are hit by a surge in COVID-19 infections. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Malian politician is expressing outrage over the assassination of a rebel leader that some are calling a peacemaker. Sidi Brahim Sidati, leader of the Coordination of Azawa Movements, was shot Tuesday morning outside his home in the Malian capital, Bamako. Opposition politician Yao Samake says the Malian government should have provided security for Sidati.
The tragic killing of Sidi Brahim Sidati, president of the Coordination of Azawad Movement, is a tragic event, and I am particularly sad for what happened. He got shot by gunmen who were not identified and on motorcycle in front of his home in the capital city of Bamako. I extend my condolences to the family of the deceased.
Do the authorities know who did the shooting?
The authorities in Mali do not know who did the shooting, and no one armed group claimed the shooting. The government of Mali is still investigating and trying to find out what happened and who did it. This is tragic, and it is deplorable that we live in a country where, even in the capital city, that the government is not protecting key players of the peace process that Mali has signed in. Sidati was the president of the SEMA, which is one of the signatories of the peace agreement in Mali, and that he could be killed in his home in the capital city of Mali without the government even knowing who did it or apprehending the killers is outrageous. This is to say that this man did not have the appropriate security details in Mali, that strategic places in Mali are not protected, and strategic partners of Mali are, or even Malian playing key role, are not protected in this country, and that is really outrageous. So I call on the government to quickly investigate and track down those killers and bring them to justice.
You said that Sidati was a major actor in the Mali peace process. What exactly was his contribution to the peace process?
Sidi Ibrahim Sidati was a major player in the peace process, as I've said. He was the president of the Coordination of Azawad Movement. He was a signatory of the peace agreement in Mali and was working on, actually, member of the commission, on the follow-up commission on the peace agreement. And I believe that this killing will be a setback in the peace process in Mali. The SEMAS is an alliance of rebel groups who were seeking autonomy for the northern part of Mali. But with the help of the international community led by Algeria, we came to a peace agreement in 2015, which was signed by the SEMA group in June of 2015. So obviously, this killing would be a setback for our peace process, but I can only hope that the signatories, including Mali government, will regroup very quickly and be able to give assurance that this incident will be resolved and the perpetrators will be brought to justice.
You also said that Sidati should have been protected. Who do you think should have protected him?
I believe that Sidati or any Malian citizen should be protected by the government of Mali, and they are the number one responsible for the security and the safety of the people of Mali. Now, Sidati's case as a key player in the peace process, I believe that the government should have provided added security measures to make sure that his life is not in peril, and that now all members of these signatory parties living in Bamako are under government protection. This looks like a neglect, and government should clarify its position and also making sure that there is assurance that key contributors to Malian political and security issues are protected.
Yaw Samaki is the Malian politician. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bamako. There was a school-related shooting Tuesday morning in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, including minors. Leonard Dodu, newsroom chief of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper, says a 16-year-old girl is dead and police are holding two 16- and 17-year-old boys.
This shooting incident that occurred in Monrovia on Tuesday early morning is the first of its kind. It occurred at a school called the Cyber Ed Christian School of Excellence, which is located right behind the home of Liberia's vice president. The school, like most Liberians will consider it, is a school that mostly the children of the upper class do attend. It's an international school. The incident occurred about 7:45 a.m. We have gathered from the police, and it occurred at a time where most of the students in the school had gone to do their breakfast before school could start. And this student in question left where they were having their breakfast and went to the classroom, according to the school authorities, to show off with the 9mm pistol that he sneaked onto the campus with. And while at it, he mistakenly, according to the school administration, fired a shot that killed one of the students.
Who is the victim? And
the victim is a 10th grade student at the school, who also happens to be the daughter of one of Liberia's famous doctors called Dr. Philip Ireland. Dr. Philip Ireland is the head of the internal medicine at Liberia's biggest referral hospital, the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center. He's also one of the doctors who was very active in helping people to recover from Ebola in 2014, and he contracted Ebola and survived.
How is the police investigation going?
On Tuesday morning, the anti-robbery unit of the police picked up two students from the school who are suspected to have connection with the shooting. The students, both of them minors, age 16 and age 17, are being investigated by the police. They are currently in police custody. Being that they are minors, the police also said that the parents of these children who live in the United States of America are cooperating to bring their legal representations, that is their lawyers, before statements can be extracted from the minors.
Is this an isolated case, and what is the policy in Liberia about students bringing guns to school?
This case is very isolated. As a matter of fact, it's the first of its kind. And this was also confirmed by the Minister of Education, who said that this has never happened in Liberia's history, as far as he's concerned. Carrying weapons to school is totally prohibited in Liberia. This is not permitted. Students are not allowed to carry even mobile phones to school. So how he got hold of the gun is one concern that the public has, that how did this 16-year-old obtain a gun? The general public is very much concerned about that, and they are also awaiting answers from the police. And how he entered the school campus with the gun without being noticed is another concern that the public has. So this is strange. This has never happened before. Somebody will say, yes, I mean, Liberian students might take razor blades to school to sharpen their pencils, but never a day has there been any reports that any student used a razor blade on another student. So using a gun on another student is very, very strange in our society.
Thank you so much again, Leonard, for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you so much, James, for having me. It's my pleasure speaking to you this morning.
Leonard Dodu is newsroom chief of Liberia's Front Page Africa. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. United Nations agencies says northern Mozambique is facing a long-lasting humanitarian and protection crisis as conflict, hunger, and disease grip hundreds of thousands of people in the region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
People are still fleeing in droves from the impact of the violence that erupted in northern Mozambique's coastal town of Palma. Many of the thousands of people who have fled to Pemba, the capital of Cabo Delgado, tell stories of the horrific attacks by Islamist militants who reportedly killed dozens of people and committed other atrocities. Speaking on a video link from Pemba, Director of Emergencies for the UN Children's Fund, Manuel Fontaine, says people relate how they have had to flee in the middle of the night. They speak in sorrow at families being separated while running for their lives.
I heard about this young woman who was pregnant and her husband was just killed in front of her. And these are constant stories, stories of people being kidnapped, stories of gender-based violence, horrific stories of ordeals of people walking for days and days, kids arriving with their feet swollen and injured and having to be taken care of.
UNICEF says malnutrition rates among displaced children in Cabo Delgado are alarmingly high, with at least 33,000 in need of life-saving specialized nutritional feeding. It says cholera and COVID-19 are of growing concern. The agency has appealed for $52.8 million for Mozambique this year, $30 million of that amount targeted for Cabo Delgado. It says only 37% of the appeal is funded, and international support for its humanitarian operation is urgently needed. In a separate appeal, the World Food Program is seeking $82 million to ramp up food aid in northern Mozambique. WFP spokesman Thompson Fieri says, in the wake of the heinous attacks in Palma, families and individuals have had to abandon their homes, their belongings, and livelihoods to flee for safety.
WFP teams on the ground have spoken to these families that are on the move, and their stories illustrate horrific violence and deepening despair. As the security situation continues to deteriorate, more than 950,000 people in the north of Mozambique are now facing severe hunger.
Fieri says the WFP plans to assist 750,000 internally displaced people and vulnerable members of the host communities in Cabo Delgado and three other northern provinces. He says WFP is organizing emergency food distribution for families who have fled the violence in Palma. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 14. Chinese and French oil companies involved in the East African crude oil pipeline project to be built from Uganda to Tanzania say affected villagers are being compensated. But rights groups representing hundreds of families who will be displaced by the project tell a different story. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
The $3.5 billion project is projected to run 1,450 kilometers from the southwestern Hoima district of Uganda to the port of Tanga in Tanzania.
I'm greatly honored to join you today
On Sunday, Presidents Yoweri Museveni of Uganda and Samia Suluhu Hassan of Tanzania signed three agreements paving the way for construction of the pipeline, expected to be completed in 2025. Chitutu Mary Goretti, Uganda's Minister for Energy and Mineral Development, says the agreements will be a significant boost into Uganda's economy and its people.
Other processes are already ongoing, including the acquisition of land for the pipeline and the EPC management activities. It is important for the people of Uganda to take note of and position themselves to benefit from the extensive activities already going on.
However, human rights organizations say pipeline construction will displace up to 10,000 people who are not being adequately compensated. Sewanyana Livingstone, the head of the Foundation for Human Rights Organization, says locals are not being heard.
Of course, the population along the pipeline are interested in compensation because they were displaced, they were not heard, they are not party to the negotiations. We are trying in our follow-up activities to see how Total can bring them on board. But at the moment, they seem to be excluded.
According to the agreement signed Sunday, French energy company Total will hold the largest stake in the pipeline with 62%. The Uganda National Oil Company and Tanzania Petroleum Development Corporation will hold each 15%. And the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, or CNOOC, will own the other 8%. Pierre Jessua, Total's general manager, says the company has not voluntarily delayed the compensation to the affected families.
It was, due to the stop and goes of this project that we had to interrupt the processes, but we never actually took the lands and deprived the people from the land. We have evaluated the land, evaluated the crops on the land, evaluated the buildings which were on the land.
Chen Zhuo Biao, president of CNOOC's Uganda branch, says very few people in their areas of jurisdiction are yet to be compensated.
We have already compensated most of the people that related to the land, and along my memory, only about 26 households did not compensate.
Upon completion, the East Africa crude oil pipeline will be the longest in the world, carrying 230,000 barrels of oil per day from Ugandan oil fields to Africa's east coast. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Zimbabwe schools are being hit by a surge in COVID-19 infections after reopening, despite criticism that they weren't prepared. Ade Gondo has details.
According to the Health Ministry's situational report, two schools in Matabele and South reported 106 cases of COVID-19, reigniting fears that schools were not ready to resume classes. Umzingwane High School and Sacred Heart Girls High School in Eskodini reported a combined 106 cases. Despite the ministry's assurances that the situation is under control, teachers' unions and others say that's not the case. Schools reopened on March 15th with students attending on alternate days as the government eased some COVID-19 restrictions. Masks, temperature checks, and washing of hands in all public areas remain in place. A national vaccination program is being rolled out. But teachers' unions have long raised questions on whether proper precautions were in place. Yesterday, a statement by the Progressive Teachers Union, PTUZ, blamed the Ministry of Primary and Secondary School for the new cases, saying COVID-19 abatement equipment in schools is in dire need. The union's president, Takawa Firajo, weighs in.
The $750 million that the government allocated to schools to buy COVID equipment seem not to have filtered to the school. It seemed to have gone into private pocket. The classes in schools are still bloated, with some teachers teaching a class of about 103 students, 90 students, and this has ensured that there is no social distance. The Minister of Education has also not recruited more teachers in order to ensure a proper teacher ratio of 1:20 as encouraged by WHO. There is no running water in schools.
Before schools reopened, ministry officials claimed they had found a high level of preparedness, a point teachers' unions reject, saying, for example, teachers, ancillary staff, and pupils were not tested. Obed Masaraure of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Unions of Zimbabwe, R2s, also said schools reopened too soon.
We warned the government of Zimbabwe against the reckless opening of schools, but they didn't take heed of our call. We are pushing for mandatory testing of all those who are going to participate in the physical school ecosystem. Unfortunately, our government chose to blindly accept both learners and teachers. It is a fact that our schools are now the super spreaders of COVID-19. It is a fact that if there is a third wave, it is being brewed in our schools.
Observers say urgent action is needed, saying it will be more costly to manage COVID-19 than to prevent the spread. Meanwhile, Masaraore confirmed that demand for vaccines is sluggish.
Very few teachers have been vaccinated. There's limited access to information on the vaccination program. And there's still a lot of skepticism on the vaccines themselves. So there was need for a lot of education so that at least we have more uptake of the vaccine by the teachers.
Observers say fractious relations between the government and its workers is in part to blame for the situation. They say dialogue would help mitigate the trust deficit. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The idea for the Collective for the Renewal of Africa, also known as CORA, began 1 year ago when three African intellectuals wrote an open letter about the pandemic and advising leaders to use it as an opportunity to change the paradigm. The positive response to their letter led the thought leaders to expand upon the idea, and CORA, Pan-African Intellectual Collective of over 100 writers, scholars from the social and natural sciences, medical doctors and artists from across Africa and the diaspora, officially launches this week as an ongoing collective with a series of conversations hosted online. Ndongo Sila, co-founder of CORA, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the group.
And you know that, yeah, we don't have the same economic structures. Our economies are strongly dominated by the informal economy. So if you implement harsh lockdown measures, you could harm much more than the virus could have done, you see. And so we are having this kind of conversation with the African leadership. And this open letter had been signed by 100 African, let's say, scholars, public intellectuals, etc., from the continent and the diaspora, and from all linguistic areas. That means the Francophone, Anglophone, Arabic speaking, and also Lusophone countries. And that was something really amazing. And because we had a tremendous success, that was initially unexpected, you know. And that message was very powerful from our side, because it meant that people are expecting something from African intellectuals, because they actually know at least now African intellectuals are starting collectively to have an opinion about what is going on in the continent. And we say that message, and we told ourselves we could not stop there. We have to build something about, let's say, around, let's say, this open letter. And that's the idea of CORA.
What is different about this collective?
Yeah, what is, I think, different, specific to CORA, is that our members are from the continent and the diaspora. And CORA reflects the linguistic diversity of the continent. That means we have Arab-speaking, Portuguese-speaking, French-speaking, English-speaking, etc. And we are also we have also all the spectrum of, let's say, competencies. We have people from the natural sciences, economists, historians, let's say, physicians, etc., and also artists.
Some of the topics addressed in your first forum are indigenous languages, indigenous approaches to solutions, and biodiversity, and economics. Why have you chosen these specific issues for this first meeting?
Yeah, somehow it is linked to the actuality of the pandemic. You see, for example, when the pandemic started, it was, let's say, global selfishness. Every country, every regional bloc say that I have to handle things myself, and after, yeah, international solidarity will come afterwards. And so Africa was left to two, three times much more vaccines than what is available for the African continent. So that means that Africa has to develop its own capacities, economic capacities, etc. And this has been revealed, let's say, clearly by the pandemic. So it's important that Africa gather its own resources in order, let's say, to have much more sovereignty, much more, let's say, technical capacities in all those areas.
That was Undongo Sila, a co-founder of Cora. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, April 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington wishing you a very good day.